And welcome to another edition of the Sea Control Podcast, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. Even through the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan as they continue, the American public and the world at large often forgets that real people are fighting these wars. Wars become headlines, they become statistics, they become policies, they become ideas. And you can understand why people are rather shocked at these things that they understand and experience in their day-to-day in a war zone. And hence, you saw recently the viral image of a fighter against ISIS playing Pokemon Go outside of Mosul on one of the defensive lines. Well, that became very popular, and we reached out to that fighter. He is a U.S. Marine Corps veteran. His name is Lewis, and he spends more time stacking up Daesh bodies like cordwood than he does collecting Pokemon. And we're going to talk to him today about his personal experience in that war zone to give you a better understanding of what it's like up in the Kurdish regions and what it's like for some of these veterans who end up going back and carrying on the fight even once they leave the service here in the United States, and in many ways continue that service with a greater risk by going back into the war zone and fighting the fight. But we will get back to Lewis and talking about what it's like fighting up in the Kurdish regions against ISIS right after a quick word from my wife.
SimSec brings you the best content on maritime security, technology, history, and international affairs. And like the United States, SimSec is and always will be free. Sign up to become a member today by visiting www.cimsec.org/about/membership, which gets you daily emails of our articles and a WordPress account that sends your own writings directly to our editorial staff. No matter how you choose to support us, we are incredibly grateful. Remember, Sea Control is more than just a podcast, and SimSec is more than just a website. We are a vibrant community built on a passion for discovery and discussion. Join us today.
All right, and we are back. So, Lewis, I've given a slight introduction to you. The listeners know that you're a Marine Corps veteran who's gone to the Kurdish regions to fight ISIS. But what we'd like to do at the beginning of every podcast is give our interviewee a chance to introduce themselves, what they think is important, and let the listener understand kind of who they are. So before we talk about you going back to fight in Iraq, maybe you can tell us a little bit about yourself, maybe your time in the U.S. Marine Corps, some of your perspectives. Give them a sense of who Lewis is.
All right. Well, I mean, I think you covered most of the bases. I'm a four-year Marine Corps veteran, Afghanistan veteran. I was with 2nd Battalion, 5th Marine. I had a pretty good experience as a Marine Corps infantryman. 0311, and that doesn't really leave you. Coming around the time that I was getting out, I was really confused of what I was going to do when I got out. And suddenly I saw an article about people coming over here. That was back in 2014. As soon as I saw that, I immediately knew what I was going to do. You know, I was going to come out here and, you know, carry on the fight. And it didn't matter that I hadn't been to Iraq. You know, I had enough Iraq veteran friends, and I believed in the mission out that we were doing for both operations, and, you know, I really wanted to come out here.
I understand that there's a lot that you can't go into, and we discussed this before the podcast. You know, they're not looking for everybody and their mom to come out there. So in so much that you can actually get into, how did you go back? So there's two sides to this. There's the logistical side of getting into Kurdistan, and then there's the other side of actually being someone to contacting the whatever authorities that are involved with the fight, that when it comes to screening, integration, and actually being assigned to a particular unit. Can you describe what you can about that process and your sort of feelings and experiences with it, and maybe a little bit about what it made you think in comparison to your experience here in the United States with the Marine Corps?
I guess it doesn't really work so much like that, you know, especially where I am in the current government, the host government here. You can't really join the Peshmerga. You know, there's individual Westerners and groups of Westerners that came out. And, you know, there's a division here with different Kurdish groups. So, for instance, down south in the Cooking area, there's been several units that taken in Westerners and assigned them in an actual military, you know, fashion, where they're in there as soldiers themselves. There's other individual Westerners who have made their way out here, and just over the year and a half, 2 years, many of them have been here at least over a year, have just found their niche with a particular unit. The role that they fill for our group, and I'll get into it in a minute, is more that of kind of a warrant officer. They don't really hold any rank or anything, but nobody really tells them what to do. They accept the responsibility, and these people, these other Westerners, including us, we cooperate with the local force. My group, being Dwight Nosha, is actually an Assyrian militia that works alongside the Peshmerga on the front line in this particular area in our AO, simply because those are the villages that those militiamen are from. And because of their cooperation with the Kurdish regional government, PA, because of their minority status, they're allowed to participate in the action on the front. And then they're also allowed to have volunteers. So we come in to Dwight. We work with the Peshmerga there on the front in cooperation, kind of like I said before, like a warrant officer. You know, nobody's truly like our commanding officer, but we follow the rules that we're given, and then we conduct ourselves in the way that we would like to work in the most effective way. So we send guys out to the berm at night. We keep guys in the back position, which isn't very far from the front, as QRF, and we train ourselves. We offer training. We equip ourselves. And, you know, if we'd like to go back to the rear, all the way back to Duhok or some other place like that, then we can. You know, we're not really subject to anything besides maybe who's willing to give us a ride. So while we're not in charge of anybody, no one's really in charge of us, just responsible for us.
You've described somewhat of a fluid position. So you're working with a militia that's working with the government that, and correct me if I'm wrong, sounds like it's a tribal group that defends sort of their own designated area, which allows the government forces to deal with larger threats. Go ahead.
Oh, yes, but they're more of a supplementary or auxiliary force that's within that, on that line, on that front line. Their particular reason and desire to be there is because of those villages, as well as their political aims of, you know, being a cooperative group as a minority. So it's not so, I wouldn't really call it tribal. And I really wouldn't say that it helps the Peshmerga really focus on other larger issues. It's more of, here's some additional forces, and here's their motivation for being in this particular area.
Without revealing OPSEC, stuff you want to avoid, so how do these groups, if they're part of that line, how does that integrate with the larger effort and force? Does the commanding officers or the leaders of your group integrate with another group, or how does that communication work? Are you familiar with how that integration works?
I guess it's so simple that, you know, it doesn't make any sense to some people because it's not as organized out here. There's a lot of decentralization. But this particular group, they just cooperate with the commander up here, and they're just here on the line. And they have their own house a little bit further back from the berm. We, as volunteers, as well as the local guys, go out to the berm every night. But yeah, they exist there, and when they're asked to do things, that's what they do.
Okay.
And it's really that simple. You know, there's not much to it.
The instinct is always to ask one question deeper, and how, or why, and you do run into these circumstances where it really is that simple. So. You've described a rather fluid environment. How do you and your other, and I'll call you guys the warrant officers, decide where to go? You're talking about training. You're talking about going out on the berm, about going out on mission. How do you guys make those decisions? And how do the Kurds, when you show up, react?
Well, I mean, in our particular area, it took a lot of work. When I first got here, that's my second time here, when I first got here in 2015, early January and February, I couldn't just show up and do that. I had to do a lot of vetting. They do a lot of meetings and stuff like that. But once we get out to the line, once we got out then, you know, they're really happy. You know, it took a little getting used to, but they're very happy we're here to help in our area specifically. And I'm assuming it's the same for other people. Their reaction is always good. And now we have a really good working relationship that we've built, and they're happy to see us every time. They know where metal's been tested. They know our backgrounds. We know theirs. So usually it's very good.
And that first question, how, if no one's in charge of you and you're really not in charge of anybody, it's this understanding. What's your process of deciding where you're going to go, who you're going to train, or what part of the line that you're going to back up? Because there's a lot, like you said, there's a lot to do out there. How do you make the decision of where to go and what you should prioritize?
Well, obviously, you know, we work within our matrix. Obviously, we work within our matrix of, you know, the area that we're in specifically. We still have the rules, you know, so we stick to those. And then we just base ourselves off of that matrix. Like, okay, well, we have X amount of Westerners and like militia guys. So we'll send this many people out to the front. You know, we already set up with the Peshmerga there, which post we want to go to, depending on the amount of personnel, how many posts we're going to man on the burn. We already have our own plan for combat. The communication isn't actually a problem because a lot of us have picked up Kurdish. Others have, you know, a lot of Kurds have a little bit of English. And we have, you know, a couple guys here who are actually translators who, from their military career, know Arabic or just their experience here, know Kurdish. So we just kind of communicate with those around us. We have a general understanding that we've built up. And, you know, we assume the post that we're ready for the night. We set the location just kind of the way we want to. And send the guys out. If anything goes down, we have our plans. We have a general understanding with the local commander on the line as well as the, you know, the actual general here, like, what we do, and so far it's worked out.
What do you, when you say the rules, are you talking about the rules of engagement? Does this come for your militia, or is this an informal set of rules that's been determined by you? Or are you referring to rules that the United States has for people who may go abroad and fight in conflicts? What are the rules that you're talking about?
Well, the rules are kind of like a matrix. In other words, like, our specific AO, we're not going to go away from. You know, there's units to our right and left, adjacent units. It's like one long trench line. So, you know, we know the other two units and we can visit them, but we really don't very much. We don't, you're not supposed to go past the burn unless the general is going out there. So we stay there. And then we set up our own rules specifically for Westerners as a group. We really don't use kind of like a rank structure as Westerners. We kind of, it's a small group. We're able to set up a community kind of command structure, but not really a command structure. Like, you're a volunteer. You can do what you want. Here's the basic rules that the locals have. If you don't want to be part of this group, what we do, that's fine. You can stay at the house or go out. But we've developed a very strong community kind of thing where, you know, if you're not willing to accept the rules and the limitations we have and have the understanding of why we do things, then we're going to kind of isolate you.
Self-policing, then.
It's been good enough to hold us together. We're all professionals. We're all on the same level. We're all adults. If somebody is in charge, if somebody has more experience with a certain issue, then they take lead on that. And we all accept that. So,
Without naming any names, of course, or going into too much particular detail, because, you know, you've volunteered to be interviewed, but you got a lot of guys out there that talk about the other kind of veterans. Like, what kind of guys are out there? So you're a Marine Corps veteran. You're not a former rifleman, always a rifleman, always a Marine. You know, we kind of imagine that's
right.
The kind of guy,
yeah.
A K-bar in the teeth. What about the other folks that are out there? When you say Westerners, is it just Americans? Are we talking France and Britain as well?
It's always been, since last year, the first time here, it's always been predominantly Americans. But, you know, we have British, we have French volunteers. Most of them are military. We have a couple civilians, but civilians are always hit or miss, you know. As one of my other buddies says, you don't become a soldier overnight, you know. And we need to come here with things to offer, skills to offer, a certain mindset that civilians just don't have. So we've had one or two good guys, but really, they usually don't last or don't work out here.
And what other backgrounds? So you're a Marine. Do you have any guys from the other services? We all expect the rifleman to be the kind of guy. Do you have any technical guys, mechanics, you know, that kind of stuff?
Mostly Army infantry, even from the other countries. You know, we have a couple specializations, a couple people who, you know, play other roles. But for them, it's predominantly Army infantry and Marine Corps infantry and British infantry, you know.
So we've talked about you, your experience, the vets that you're working with. Let's talk about the Kurds. So you're working very closely with these guys on the ground. You're on the berm with them at night. You're training with them. You're learning a little bit of Kurdish. There's a lot of back and forth. Give me a picture. Who are these folks? Former rebels fighting against, who fought against Saddam. I mentioned you got new trainees. What is this force like? What does it look like? Who are these people? Kind of describe the kind of unit that you're in.
I'd have to really dig deep into, you know, history and politics in order to explain the Kurds, you know, and then, of course, the politics between the Kurds. You know, not every Kurd like the other Kurds, but the host government that I'm in is the PDK, government under Barzani. And those Kurds eventually want their independence, obviously. Right now, they work to fight ISIS alongside the coalition. And probably the most favorable group out here. The Kurds specifically in this unit would be better for me to describe. These people, they want their own homeland and everything, but right now they're focused on fighting ISIS, recapturing the lands for the Assyrians, for the Yazidis, for, you know, everybody out here in order to, you know, take care of the politics back in the rear. They want to make the politics of ISIS or just to kill you all.
Well, my question wasn't
the fighters,
about
the individual Kurds are great people.
My question wasn't about the politics in particular. I was actually asking specifically that. I wanted to know about, on a personal level, tell me about the kind of Kurds that you've found yourself fighting with.
So the adjacent two units are actually one division, and they're, you know, an actual Peshmerga force, full armament, full pay. The unit that we're with, and between the two parts of the front, is actually considered an anti-terror unit. And a lot of these Kurds, they're volunteered not to get paid very much. They work for a general who is very famous here. I'm not going to say his name.
Of course.
But the general here, he's a very, very well-known, very famous individual. And they've all volunteered to work for him for a lot less. They're a skilled fighter. It hasn't always been here. They've been sent to Sinjar, Shingal. They've been sent all different places around the dam, Mosul Dam. And they're known as, you know, the Black Devils is what ISIS calls them. They kick ass. They're very good people. We have a good relationship with them, so.
What's the age like?
Some of them are older, some of them are younger, you know, all around. A lot of them, you know, they're refugees from other places that ISIS took over and have come to this unit. So, you know, the mixed background of age. A lot of young guys, a couple old guys, mostly my age or older, you know, but some are younger.
You mentioned earlier that the unit you're with, they get kind of special tasking, and you mentioned in particular that they get less pay. That enters into the question of sort of the military day-to-day, and something that folks, I imagine, don't think about a lot is that these forces fighting ISIS, the Kurds, the militias, there's still military admin that exists, you know, even in a fluid organization like yours. So when it comes to stuff like pay and leave and just those sort of general, real, bottom-of-the-barrel admin stuff that people always forget about, how does that work? Are you paid? And you and I were just talking earlier where you were on R&R this week. How does that even work? How does that work for you? Like, how do they decide when? So how does that all work for not just you, but also the Kurds?
So with the militia, like Nosha, the Assyrians, who, by the way, have a very similar background, as I've mentioned, you know, older and younger people, you know, they're on. Hold on.
Sure.
Okay, they're all, you know, in a very similar boat. They all rotate every week, so you have a group that comes out one week, a group that comes out the other week. Same with the Wake, the Assyrians, the pay, you know, because Wake is its own independent body that just works alongside the Kurds with their own independent political organization that supports them, they get paid that way, and the Peshmerga here just get paid, you know, bi-monthly or whenever the pay comes in.
And when these guys rotate, some of them you mentioned were refugees, but do a lot of them just go back to their homes, to their families, so it's a week of their normal lives and then a week of being at the front?
Yeah, pretty much.
And how does the pay work? Are you paid? I mean, it's sort of a blunt question. We know that's not why you're out there. Oh, you're not.
Yeah. It's illegal for me to be paid. I'd be effectively a mercenary, and I think Reagan made that illegal.
Okay.
So, I have my money. I have my money from my, like I said, it's my second time coming here. My first time, I had some money left over from the Marine Corps, and I had donations. This time, I do get a little donation money to bring in. But for the most part, I basically have a lot of money to go work. I was working a contract in Afghanistan with Aegis, with Garda World. And then the area that I was before got hit, so I decided to come back. So I have a lot of money put away. And then I get a little donation money, and that's how I survive out here.
And if you don't mind me asking, and of course, if this is not on the table, let me know. So you said donation money. What are the kinds of groups that are supporting you? Because A, I'm not trying to brown nose here, but let me thank you for the fact that you're out there fighting this fight for no pay. It doesn't matter how much you've put away. You're out there on the line fighting these guys, and you're doing it because you think it's right, and that's incredible. But who are these groups that are supporting you with donations? Like, where are they from? Like, kind of what are their motivations? And
it's really family and friends.
Okay.
Yeah, it's family and friends, basically. Occasionally someone else gives me I have an outreach on Instagram and on Facebook, and people will add me, and follow me and everything. And it's quite a following. But other than that, it's just basically family and friends and spending a little bit of money. You don't need a lot out here. For weapons and for ammunition, I've used a lot of my own money, but don't send a little bit for that. So
you pay for your own weapons and ammunition as well?
Yeah, so it was better for me to do that than to take from the Kurds or the Assyrians, because they have limited amounts as it is.
You're just heading back from R&R now, and we actually, this podcast was delayed a little bit, the recording, because you talked about how you're in traffic. And Erbil, you weren't out in Erbil, but I was thinking about it last night. It's only 60 miles from Mosul, it's only 60 miles from the front. And people are working and living there. What is that like for a lot of these folks? Do they talk about it?
It's often weird. You have people who live here in the town now, who are from the towns that ISIS have taken, but life just kind of carries on past the line, 10 kilometers past the front line, everything's fine. People, they're ready to evacuate if they had to, but already the support. But other than that, everybody carries on their lives. The Peshmerga and the cops here do a very good job to protect the people.
Along with that, since people are living their normal lives here, and we're starting to get towards those dumb Pokemon Go questions, but they're coming, is that you've got cell phone coverage,
yeah.
You've got network connectivity. Before we ask about sort of the stuff you guys do for R&R and kind of what that part of the life is, do you find yourself using cell phones and iPads and that kind of stuff in combat? And what are some of the more interesting innovations that you've seen your fighters come up with?
Yeah, I mean, we have stories of people using WhatsApp to call for an airstrike. Obviously, we all have pretty good coverage of the mobile Wi-Fi routers that we have here, the hotspot.
Right.
I have an international plan, so my data works too. Different parts of the front obviously have different types of coverage. We just got lucky on ours. I've used my phone to help aim mortars with an app that helps me with the angle because the mortars don't have angle.
Right.
Other than that, I've used my phone to record, and catalog things going on here, the engagements we've had. It'd be better if I had a GoPro, but I use my phone to film one of the engagements we had recently. And obviously, the footage wasn't that great, but the best I could do.
And speaking of innovation, so in the United States, we've seen a lot of pictures of these modified or ad hoc kind of armored vehicles that have been created in the field. Have you had to fight any of these, and have you used any or yourself? And do you kind of have any thoughts on this sort of homemade battle wagons?
During the fight for Telescope, they used a bunch. I wasn't here for it. But you still see like the Husk kind of thing. People RPGs to the steel will take them out. Usually they're smart about it though. They'll space the steel out. They'll put sand in. They'll do everything they can to divert or disperse the flame jet coming from the rocket, the penetrator.
Let's talk about R&R. So, of course, the reason that you and I ended up connected is a mutual friend of ours mentioned it when everyone started seeing your photo from your cell phone playing Pokemon Go on the front. One of the things folks don't, again, think about is that there's real people fighting this war. And just like everybody else, you guys look for your distractions. You don't just want to think about killing these lunatics that are setting kids on fire all day. I mean, the kind of people that you're fighting are horrible, and war itself, of course, is, as you can attest from your time in Afghanistan at the front, is horrible. So what do you guys use to distract yourself? You know, you're getting into the new craze, Pokemon Go. What else do you guys do on the front to distract yourself or to build camaraderie? And when you head back on R&R, what do you do in Kurdistan? Kind of what are the things that you engage in? Are you visiting historical stuff? Because you talked about how 10 kilometers from the front, life is normal. So what is that like when you head back and you detox for a week?
Okay, so obviously Pokemon Go, I downloaded it with my phone. I just wanted to check it out. I just wanted to see if it worked here in Iraq, especially up the front. And, of course, it did. You know, you have three starters when you first play the game. So the reason I was able to capture one later on that burn was because it's one of the starters. Hearing from one of my friends, though, who's out there when I was on R&R, that he walked around the town that we're in and found a couple Pokemon, which was crazy to hear. So I'll try that when I get there. I haven't really played the game very much. I've only captured, like, two Pokemon. So, to be honest, you know, we come for R&R, you know, because we go to the Christian and Yazidi areas that sell alcohol. You get a little bit of drink and try and, like, just get relaxed. Okay, just to get a little relaxation from the personal responsibilities that we have, especially some of those of us who have been here for a while and really organize things. We really need a break from that sometimes. And on top of that, just the day-to-day schedule and the heat, you know, we want to get rest, actual good sleep. So, yeah, just that's what we do for R&R. We go out, we visit places, we go out to eat and get some good food instead of the rice and beans that we eat here. Say, other than that, you know, we're actually really focused out here. We say, even on R&R, we're buying ammo and supplies and gear and talking about what we need to do on the front. On the front, we really don't distract ourselves very much. We're very focused on what we do, and that's why sometimes we need a break.
Right, right. So one of the things that ISIS does, other than destroying human lives, is destroying sort of human history. And there's a lot of monuments and relics that they've destroyed.
Yes, of course.
And when you said that during your R&R, you'll go out and you kind of visit stuff. Do you go out and do you visit some of these historical monuments, these historical places while you're in R&R? Because
yes.
I know you've got other priorities, but...
Right. I mean, I visited some of the monasteries before. I visited Howard, Erbil, the main citadel out there. But for the most part, it's really hot right now, so I don't go around a lot.
Right, right.
It's very, very, very hot.
All right, so as you can hear from the background, Lewis is actually on his way back to the front. We're a little bit over our time, and I really appreciate him agreeing to interview with us. But, Lewis, before we close out, as I do with all the other folks that we interview, not a question, just a platform. So any final thoughts that you have, anything that our listeners should follow, any reflections you have on your time in Kurdistan, on conflict in general, on your time in the Marine Corps, whatever you think it's important for them to know that I haven't asked you, the floor is yours.
All right. Well, we covered all the bases. You know, I just want to, like, my main concern was that the image, you know, got viral, kind of makes things a joke. And, you know, it's not a joke out here. And I want the focus... I'd hope the people who see the image would, and the articles out there would inquire as to what's going on and maybe raise attention to what's going on here. You know, I don't need the attention. The Kurds, the Syrians out here, they need the attention. And, you know, the world needs to pay attention to what's happening here because, as you can see from these terrorist attacks and everything going on around the world, you know, everybody's problem, the world's problem, and it needs to end because as long as ISIS is allowed to exist, these people will keep being, you know, influenced by them or inspired by them. You know, and like I said, it's no joke. Like, the other day, got, you know, hit by a mortar and, you know, blown off my feet and fortunately survived. And, you know, it's not a joke out here.
And, you know, there's a lot of other folks out there, like in Nice in France yesterday, who they know as well. This fight is real where you're fighting it, and it's becoming real for a lot more people around the world. And Lewis, you know, I'm not just thanking you for agreeing to interview with us, but you, all the guys out there, the veterans that are doing this for no pay, just fighting the good fight that you think is right, for the Kurds that are fighting with you, for the Assyrians, for the refugees that take up arms. You know, this is a righteous fight, and a lot of people from all over the world putting their lives on the line, either because they're in the services, you know, they're in the Air Force jets flying overhead, or they're the Marines in the Army, the guys that are going back to Iraq, or it's guys like you that are doing of your own volition, or it's the guys that are standing next to you, that this is about their individual homes, this is about their families 10 miles away. You know, you guys are doing the right thing, and all of us really do owe you a debt of gratitude.
Thank you very much.
All right, Lewis. Well, this has been a great interview, and I appreciate your time, and best of luck heading back out to there to the front.
All right. Thank you very much, Semper Fi.
You're damn right.